This CLE is based on the appellate decisions released in October of 2019 addressing issues related to civil procedure. The summaries of these decisions were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in October 2019, and they've since been compiled into an update pamphlet, the October 2019 Civil Procedure pamphlet. And it is that pamphlet that serves as the written materials for this CLE, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is U.S. Bank versus Sanson on page 5. It deals with the requirement of a 90-day notice in a foreclosure action. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the foreclosure action should not have been dismissed for failure to prosecute because a 90-day notice had not been served. The court said, a court may not dismiss an action based on neglect to prosecute unless the statutory preconditions to dismissal, as articulated in CPLR 3216, are met. These conditions include, among others, service of a written demand requiring the party against whom such relief is sought to resume prosecution of the action and to serve and file a note of issue within 90 days after receipt of the demand. That's CPLR 3216, subdivision B3. Here, the Supreme Court was without power to direct dismissal of the action on the ground of failure to prosecute because the plaintiff was not served with a written demand to serve and file a note of issue within 90 days. Next is the Porco case on page 6. It deals with whether an issue is ripe for appeal. Third Department held that plaintiffs Joan and Christopher Porco were not aggrieved by Supreme Court's ruling and therefore could not appeal it. The underlying action alleged civil rights law right to privacy violations related to a film made by defendant about a crime committed by Christopher Porco, one of the plaintiffs. The complaint alleged the film had been republished, making the action timely. Supreme Court denied the motion without prejudice to try again after discovery. So because the motion was denied without prejudice and the motion could be brought again after discovery, the parties were not aggrieved by the Supreme Court's decision, and therefore the appeal was dismissed on that ground. Next is Matter of Rosenberg. It's on page 7. It stands for the proposition that an arbitration award that is not final should not be confirmed. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the arbitration award should not have been confirmed because it was indefinite and non-final. And the court explained the law. Although judicial review of arbitration awards is limited, an award will be vacated when the arbitrator making the award so imperfectly executed it that a final and definite award upon the subject matter submitted was not made. That's CPLR 7511, subdivision B13. An arbitration award will be vacated as indefinite or non-final for purposes of CPLR 7511 if it does not dispose of a particular issue raised by the parties, or if it leaves the parties unable to determine their rights and obligations, if it does not resolve the controversy submitted, or if it creates a new controversy. Here the appellant established that the arbitration award was indefinite, non-final, inasmuch as it did not clearly define how the accounts receivable that were incurred prior to the date of the award were to be distributed. Next is the Farnham case on pages 7 and 8. It deals with a choice of law issue. The Fourth Department held New York law applies in this action stemming from an accident in Pennsylvania. The court wrote, New York law controls the resolution of this motion and this appeal. Because New York is the forum state, that is, the action was commenced here, New York's choice of law principles govern the outcome of this matter. The first step in any case presenting a potential choice of law issue is to determine whether there is an actual conflict between the laws of the jurisdictions involved. Here, defendant failed to establish the existence of any conflict between New York and Pennsylvania law with respect to the issues raised in the motion, and therefore we need not engage in any choice of law analysis. Next is the Maddox case on page 8. It's a Court of Appeals case dealing with class actions brought by tenants against landlords. It's not a definitive decision. It basically decided that the matter should move forward for a ruling on whether the prerequisites for a class action suit were met. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Fahey over a three-judge dissent, held the pre-answer motion to dismiss a class action claim by tenants alleging various forms of rent overcharges was properly denied, and the matter should move on for a ruling on whether the prerequisites for a class action under CPLR Section 902 are met. The court described the issue like this. Are we to look at the common basis for a damages claim or the degree of damage alleged? On the one hand, if, as defendants suggest, the differences in the specific means of harm is considered, that is, if at this stage the court contemplates nuances of how these overcharges allegedly were accomplished, then plaintiffs may struggle to satisfy the factual component of CPLR Section 901A2. On the other hand, as plaintiffs note, to focus on potential idiosyncrasies within the class claims, distinctions that speak to damages, not to liability, at this juncture would potentially be to reward bad actors who execute a common method to damage in slightly different ways. So the majority concluded that the action should not be dismissed at this pre-answer stage, but should go forward to see whether the facts will meet the prerequisites for a class action under CPLR Section 902. Next is the Cromedy case on page 9. It deals with a directed verdict. The court found that the directed verdict ruling was premature and ordered a new trial. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, setting aside the verdict and ordering a new trial, held that the motion for a directed verdict should not have been granted prior to the close of the plaintiff's case. Plaintiff had brought an action against the City of New York, pursuant to 42 U.S.C. 1983, alleging he had not received a fair trial. The court said, "The denial of a fair trial claim is a standalone cause of action, which should not have been dismissed prior to the conclusion of plaintiff's case in chief. CPLR Section 4401 permits a party to move for a directed verdict after the close of the evidence presented by an opposing party with respect to such cause of action or issue. It is reversible error to grant a motion for a directed verdict prior to the close of the party's case against whom a directed verdict is sought, even if the ultimate success of a plaintiff's cause of action is unlikely." Next is Matter of New York State Board of Regents on pages 9 and 10. It's an administrative law case. It deals with whether the State University of New York Board of Trustees Charter School Committee had the power to issue regulations concerning the teacher certification requirements for teachers in certain charter schools. And the court determined that the committee, the State University New York Board of Trustees Charter School Committee, did not have that power, and that the power resided in the Commissioner of Education. The court wrote, "We conclude that Education Law Section 355, Subdivision 2A, does not authorize the committee to promulgate regulations pertaining to teacher licensure and certification. We further find that the regulations conflict with the provisions of the education law that authorize the Commissioner of Education, to prescribe regulations governing the certification of teachers, and that require most teachers in charter schools and pre-kindergartens to be certified in the same manner as other public school teachers. The committee therefore exceeded its authority in promulgating the regulations. Next is the Halla case on pages 10 and 11. It deals with the issue whether a stay imposed by a South Carolina court should be given full faith and credit in a related action in New York. Second Department held that the stay imposed by a South Carolina court after the medical malpractice carrier, Oceanus, was declared insolvent and dissolved was not entitled to full faith and credit in the New York actions against parties insured by Oceanus. Oceanus was not a party to the New York actions, and due process trumped the Uniform Insurers Liquidation Act, that's the UILA. The court said, notwithstanding the goals of the UILA, the principles of due process and the right of the plaintiffs to seek redress in the courts in New York for wrongs they allege occurred in New York mandate that the South Carolina order is not entitled to full faith and credit or comity by the courts in New York in this and the related actions. Next is the U.S. Bank case on page 11. Has to do with a sua sponte action taken by the judge, granting relief that was not requested by the parties in a foreclosure case. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judge should not have sua sponte granted relief in this foreclosure action, which was not requested by the defendant. The court said, the court may grant relief that is warranted pursuant to a general prayer for relief contained in a notice of motion if the relief granted is not too dramatically unlike the relief sought, the proof offered supports it, and there's no prejudice to any party. Here, the defendants did not request an extension of time to answer, and the Supreme Court's determination to sua sponte grant that relief was an improvident exercise of discretion. Indeed, to extend the time to answer the complaint, a defendant must generally provide a reasonable excuse for the delay and demonstrate a potentially meritorious defense to the action. Here, the only excuse offered by the defendants for their default was the plaintiff's alleged failure to properly serve them, which excuse was rejected by the Supreme Court. Further, the defendants did not proffer any potentially meritorious defense to the action. Next case is Matter of Cody R.R. It's on page 12. It's a family law case, and it deals with a jurisdiction issue. Third Department, reversing family court, held family court should not have relinquished jurisdiction without considering the factors required by statute before finding New York to be an inconvenient forum. Mother had relocated to Florida with the children, and father brought a petition and an order to show cause alleging mother refused to allow telephone and electronic contact with the children. The court said, mother's counsel made a request for dismissal of the petition on jurisdictional grounds pursuant to the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act. That's the Domestic Relations Law, Article 5A. The acronym is UCCJEA for that act. The father opposed this request, advising that he had not received the notice of limited appearance and did not know that jurisdiction would be contested at the initial appearance. Following a brief discussion with counsel, family court granted the mother's request, dismissed the petition, denied the relief sought in the order to show cause, and directed all further proceedings to take place in Florida. And then the father appealed. The court continued, family court erred in summarily relinquishing jurisdiction. As the court acknowledged, it had exclusive continuing jurisdiction over the matter pursuant to the UCCJEA. Although a court may decline to exercise such jurisdiction upon finding that New York is an inconvenient forum and another state is a more appropriate forum, Such a determination must be made in accord with the statutory directives established within Domestic Relations Law Section 76-F. Those statutory requirements were not met here. Next is Matter of Hamrahi on pages 13 and 14. It's another family law jurisdiction case, this time dealing with subject matter jurisdiction. Second Department, reversing family court, held that a hearing was necessary on whether the court had subject matter jurisdiction for this petition seeking an order of protection. The court wrote, "The petitioner commenced this proceeding pursuant to Family Court Act Article 8, seeking an order of protection against Cynthia J. Brock. The petitioner alleged that she and Brock were in an intimate relationship and that the petitioner was the paternal great-grandmother of Brock's child, and that she and Brock had lived together in the past. The petitioner further alleged that although her grandson and the child had moved out of her home a month earlier, Brock continued to routinely drop off the child at petitioner's home after Brock's parental access time with the child, and used these opportunities to threaten, abuse, and annoy the petitioner. The petitioner also alleged that Brock telephoned the child on a daily basis and verbally harassed the petitioner on the phone. Subsequently, Brock made an application to dismiss the petition for lack of subject matter jurisdiction on the ground that the relationship between her and the petitioner did not qualify as an intimate relationship within the meaning of Family Court Act Section 812(1)(e). Family Court granted the application and dismissed the petition. And again, the Second Department held that Family Court should have held a hearing to determine the nature of the relationship because subject matter jurisdiction depended on the nature of the relationship. So the court went on. The family court is a court of limited subject matter jurisdiction and cannot exercise powers beyond those granted to it by statute. Pursuant to Family Court Act Section 812, Subdivision 1, the family court's jurisdiction in family offense proceedings is limited to certain prescribed criminal acts that occur between spouses or former spouses, or between parent and child, or between members of the same family or household. For purposes of Family Court Act Article 8, members of the same family or household include persons who are not related by consanguinity or affinity and who are or have been in an intimate relationship, regardless of whether such persons have lived together at any time. Expressly excluded from the ambit of intimate relationship are casual acquaintances and ordinary fraternization between two individuals in business or social contexts. Beyond those delineated exclusions, what qualifies as an intimate relationship within the meaning of Family Court Act Section 812, Subdivision 1E, is determined on a case-by-case basis. Relevant factors include the nature or type of relationship, regardless of whether the relationship is sexual in nature, the frequency of interaction between the persons, and the duration of the relationship. So to reiterate, Family Court would not have statutory jurisdiction over this family offense case unless the parties were involved in an intimate relationship and that determination could only be made after holding a hearing. Next is the Grandelli case on page 14, another jurisdiction case, this time involving long-arm jurisdiction. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held New York did not have jurisdiction over a French company called Warner Europe, which manufactured elevator brakes in this elevator malfunction case. The French company sold the brakes to other companies, which incorporated the brakes into their elevator AC drives. The court wrote, Warner Europe established that it does not sell the elevator brakes it manufactures in France to any customers in New York, or contact with any other company to distribute its elevator brakes to customers in New York. Instead, it sells its elevator brakes as component parts to other manufacturers, which incorporate them into AC drives, which are then sold to other manufacturers that incorporate the AC drives containing the elevator brakes into elevator systems. Warner Europe also established that it has no knowledge of the end users of the elevator brakes, and that it does not sell replacement elevator brakes or component parts to the end user customers who purchased the elevators into which they were incorporated. Warner Europe also established that its products were neither sold nor advertised online. Finally, Warner Europe showed that it has no real or personal property in New York, no registered agent or telephone number in New York, and no bank or investment account in New York, and that it does not advertise in New York. Thus, the record does not support a finding that Warner Europe knew or reasonably should have known that its manufacture and sale of elevator brakes would have a direct consequence in New York, such that long-arm jurisdiction could be exercised. Next is J.P. Morgan Chase on page 15. It's another jurisdiction case, this time dealing with the effect of a notice of appearance on jurisdiction. Second Department held defendant's counsel had waived any lack of personal jurisdiction in this foreclosure action by filing a notice of appearance, notwithstanding that the statement in the notice said that jurisdictional defenses were not waived. The court wrote, "The filing of a notice of appearance in an action by a party's counsel serves as a waiver of any objection to personal jurisdiction in the absence of either the service of an answer which raises a jurisdictional objection or a motion to dismiss pursuant to CPLR 3211A8 for lack of personal jurisdiction." Here the defendant's counsel filed a notice of appearance, and the defendants did not move to dismiss the complaint insofar as asserted against them on the ground of lack of personal jurisdiction at that time, or assert lack of personal jurisdiction in a responsive pleading. It is immaterial that the notice of appearance, in addition to requesting that all papers in the action be served on the defendant's counsel, stated that the defendants do not waive any jurisdictional defenses by reason of the appearance. Next is Wells Fargo Bank on page 16, another jurisdiction case, this time dealing with the death of a party. Third Department held that the death of a party in this foreclosure proceeding deprived the court of jurisdiction. Therefore, the court should not have considered defendant's motion, and the related order was a nullity. The court said, "The death of a party generally stays in action until a personal representative is substituted for the deceased party. Because an automatic stay was in effect upon the death of the party, Supreme Court was without jurisdiction to consider defendant's motion, and therefore the amended order is a nullity." Next is Errant Gene Therapeutics on page 17. It has to do with the right to a jury trial. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff had waived its right to a jury trial by including a request for equitable relief, and it also held that once that right was waived, the right cannot be revived. The court wrote, "When, as here, the complainant either joins legal and equitable causes of action arising out of the same alleged wrong, or seeks both legal and equitable relief, there is a waiver of plaintiff's right to a jury trial. Once the right to a jury trial has been intentionally lost by joining legal and equitable claims, any subsequent dismissal, settlement, or withdrawal of the equitable claim will not revive the right to a trial by jury." Next is the Schultz case on pages 17 and 18. It has to do with standing under the State Environmental Quality Review Act. Third Department held plaintiff did not have standing to contest the negative declaration issued by the town under the State Environmental Quality Review Act because the sewer construction approved by the town was 15 miles from plaintiff's property. The Third Department also found that plaintiff's actions should have been brought as an Article 78 and were therefore time-barred. The court wrote, "In land use matters especially, the Court of Appeals has long imposed the limitation that the plaintiff, for standing purposes, must show that he or she would suffer direct harm, injury that is in some way different from that of the public at large, and this requirement applies whether the challenge to governmental action is based on a CEQA violation, that's State Environmental Environmental Quality Review Act violation or other grounds. Plaintiff does not reside in the town. Although his homestead apparently straddles the town line, such that 1.2 acres of his land is situated in the town, his property is located outside of and approximately 15 miles away from the sewer district. Moreover, plaintiff's status as a taxpayer by itself does not grant him standing to challenge the establishment of a sewer district. Plaintiff's State Environmental Quality Review Act challenge is also time-barred. Regardless of how a plaintiff may label or style his or her claim, courts must look to the core of the underlying claim and the relief sought, and if the claim could have been properly addressed in the context of a CPLR Article 78 proceeding, a 4-month statute of limitations will apply. Next is matter of Nunes on pages 18 and 19. It primarily deals with the criteria for filing a late notice of claim when the lawsuit is against a municipality. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court over a partial dissent, determined the 42 U.S.C. 1983 action was not subject to the notice of claim requirement of the general municipal law. The notice of claim for malicious prosecution cause of action was timely because the limitations period began when the underlying charges were dismissed. And three, the petition for leave to file late notices of claim for the state law discrimination, false arrest, abusive process, excessive force, failure to intervene, denial of access to the courts, intimidation, and intentional infliction of emotional distress actions should not have been granted. And with regard to the late notice of claim, the court wrote, the petitioner's explanation that the counsel who represented him during the criminal proceeding did not advise him of the notice of claim requirement and that he did not learn of the requirement until he retained his current attorney to represent him in a potential civil action did not constitute a reasonable excuse for his failure to timely serve the village with a notice of claim for the state law claims. The petitioner's ignorance of the law does not constitute a reasonable excuse. Moreover, the petitioner's assertion that he knowingly delayed commencing any action against the village while the criminal charges were pending due to unsubstantiated claims of fear and intimidation does not constitute a reasonable excuse. The petitioner did not establish that the village acquired actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting these state law claims within 90 days after they arose or a reasonable time thereafter. Generally, knowledge of a police officer or of a police department cannot be considered actual knowledge of the public corporation itself regarding the essential facts of a claim. For a report to provide actual knowledge of the essential facts, one must be able to readily infer from that report that a potentially actionable wrong had been committed by the public corporation. Here, the involvement of a village police officer in arresting the petitioner did not, without more, establish that the village acquired actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting petitioner's remaining state law claims within 90 days following their accrual or a reasonable time thereafter. Next is PHH Mortgage Corporation on pages 19 and 20. It has to do with whether a party was a necessary party. Second Department held the estate's motion to intervene in a foreclosure proceeding was properly denied. When Sidney Burt, a joint tenant with right of survivorship, died, his interest in the property subject to the foreclosure action passed to the joint tenant, Karen Berkeley, and not to Sidney's estate. Therefore, the estate did not have the right to intervene in the foreclosure. Next is Bank of New York on pages 20 and 21. It has to do with neglect to prosecute, a motion pursuant to CPLR 3216B1. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held Supreme Court was without authority to dismiss sua sponte the complaint in this foreclosure action because 1, issue had not been joined, and 2, there was no evidence plaintiff failed to appear at a settlement conference. The court wrote, CPLR 3216B1 states that no dismissal should be made under this statute unless issue has been joined. A court may not dismiss an action based on neglect to prosecute unless the CPLR 3216 statutory preconditions to dismissal are met. Here, none of the defendants submitted an answer to the complaint, and the issue was never joined. Since at least one precondition set forth in CPLR 3216 was not met, Supreme Court was without the power to dismiss the action pursuant to that statute. Next is the Dabo case on page 21, has to do with privilege in an insurer's accident investigation report. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that an insurer's accident investigation report was privileged and was not discoverable. The court wrote, documents in an insurer's claim file, including an accident investigation report, that were prepared for litigation against its insured are immune from disclosure, and it cites CPLR 3101, subdivision D2. Although documents in a first-party insurance action prepared in an insurer's ordinary course of business in investigating whether to accept or reject coverage are discoverable, citing CPLR 3101, subdivision G, there is no indication that such documents are being protected here. In the absence of any demonstration of hardship by plaintiff, the insurer's accident investigation report remains privileged. Next is matter of Vance on pages 21 and 22. It has to do with the power of a judge to remove a criminal matter to family court when the matter involves a juvenile. First Department denied the People's Article 78 action seeking to vacate an order by the respondent judge severing two counts which had been combined in an indictment and removing the charges to family court. The People objected to removing the prosecution of a 16-year-old to family court. In order to facilitate the removal, the respondent judge severed the two counts. The People unsuccessfully argued the judge did not have the authority to sever the counts and therefore could not send the charges to family court. The court wrote, the law is clear that the determination of whether the charges were in fact properly joinable in the first instance is a duty of the court that is not delegated to the prosecution or the grand jury. The court has a duty to examine the indictment to determine whether joinder is proper pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law 200.20A or B. The People have not provided any precedent to support their position to the contrary. Courts routinely rule on the issue of whether charges in an indictment are properly joinable and sever those charges that are not. While the People disagree with the court's finding that the charges were not properly joinable under CPLR 200.20, determination of this issue is not before us in this Article 78 proceeding. Rather, we are only asked, and we only have the authority to determine whether the court acted without jurisdiction or in excess of its authority, and the Second Department determined that the court acted within its authority. Next is U.S. Bank National Association, pages 22 and 23. It deals with standing in a foreclosure action, and this is a recurrent theme in the foreclosure cases that the proof offered in the summary judgment motions by the bank often does not meet the business records exception to the hearsay rule. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the bank's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted because the evidence of standing submitted by the bank did not meet the requirements of the business records exception to the hearsay rule. The court wrote, the plaintiff failed to meet its prima facie burden of establishing it had standing. The affidavits of Andrea Cruz, vice president of loan documentation for Wells Fargo Bank, the plaintiff's servicer, failed to lay the proper foundation under the business records exception to the hearsay rule to support her assertion that the note was transferred to the plaintiff's custodian prior to commencement of the action and remained in the possession of plaintiff's custodian at the time of commencement. Next is HSBC Bank on pages 23 and 24, another foreclosure case, this time raising the issue of when the statute of limitations begins to run. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment, contending the bank's action was time-barred and the bank failed to comply with real property actions and proceedings law, section 1304, should have been denied. The 2010 letter from the bank, which mentioned that the loan would be accelerated if the arrears were not paid, did not serve to accelerate the debt, and the defendant did not demonstrate the bank failed to comply with the notice requirements of Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, 1304. The court wrote, the language of the 2010 notice of default did not serve to accelerate the loan, as it was nothing more than a letter discussing acceleration as a possible future event, which does not constitute an exercise of the mortgage's optional acceleration clause. Therefore, the statute did not run in 2010 when that letter was sent. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on the attorney affirmation for this October 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The verification code is limitation. Again, the verification code for this October 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE is limitation. Next is the DiGasare case on pages 24 and 25. It deals with an attempt to shorten the statute of limitations by a clause in a subcontract and also a clause in a bond, apparently. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff subcontractor's breach of contract action against the general contractor and the insurance company, which issued the labor and material payment bond for the construction work, should not have been dismissed, and plaintiff was entitled to summary judgment on its action against the general contractor. The Third Department held that the six-month statute of limitations in the subcontract and the one-year statute of limitations in the bond did not render the action time-barred. The court wrote, a limitation period that expires before suit can be brought is not really a limitation period at all, but simply a nullification of the claim. The conflict in the subcontractor agreement between the limitation period and the payment provisions had the effect of nullifying plaintiff's breach of contract claim. Thus, the six-month limitation period is unreasonable and unenforceable, and Supreme Court should not have dismissed plaintiff's complaint as time barred. Next is Matter of Louis L.V. on pages 26 and 27. It's a family law case, but it involves the civil procedure law covering the admissibility of prior testimony. Second Department, reversing family court, held the transcript of the Family Court Act 1028 hearing seeking the quick return of a child temporarily removed pending a fact-finding hearing, should not have been used to replace the abuse-neglect fact-finding hearing because the proof requirements are different. The court wrote, Family Court Act Section 1028 permits a parent to apply for the return of a child who has been temporarily removed from the custody of the parent pending the fact-finding hearing on the issue of abuse or neglect. A Section 1028 hearing is intended to give a parent an opportunity for prompt reunion with the child pending trial. In analyzing an application for a child's return under Family Court Act Section 1028, a court must engage in a test balancing the imminent risk with the best interests of the child and, where appropriate, the reasonable efforts made to avoid removal or continuing removal. Section 1028 hearings, however, were not intended to replace fact-finding hearings as the evidentiary standards are different. Family Court Act Section 1046 provides that only competent, material, and relevant evidence may be admitted at a fact-finding hearing, whereas evidence in a dispositional hearing and during all other stages of a proceeding under Family Court Act Article 10 need only be material and relevant. A determination on an application pursuant to Section 1028 should not be taken as any indication of what ultimate determination should be made by the family court as to the petition alleging abuse and neglect. At a fact-finding hearing, any determination that a child is an abused or neglected child must be based on a preponderance of the evidence. Civil procedure law, CPLR, 4517, which governs the admissibility of prior testimony in a civil action, is applicable here, as the Family Court Act does not prescribe the issue of whether testimony from a prior hearing pursuant to the Family Court Act, Article 10, may be admitted into evidence on petitioner's direct case in a fact-finding hearing. Pursuant to CPLR 4517A3, prior trial testimony of a witness may be used by any party for any purpose against another party if the court finds that such witness is dead or otherwise unavailable. In this matter, the family court made no such finding. And the final case in this CLE, the required notice for presenting witnesses, in this case treating physicians, as witnesses at trial. First Department held the trial court properly precluded the defendants from calling plaintiffs treating physicians as witnesses and properly redacted plaintiffs' medical records. Plaintiff, a teenager with autism, brought this action against police officers for assault, battery, and use of excessive force. Defendants did not give timely notice of their wish to call the treating doctors and did not supply their own suggested redactions for the medical records. The court wrote, "We find that under the circumstances, the trial court did not improvidently exercise its discretion in precluding defendants from introducing testimony from plaintiffs' treating doctors at Ferncliff Manor. Defendants failed to disclose any of these witnesses until 4 days before trial, after having previously affirmatively represented to the court that they did not intend to call any witnesses. The court and plaintiffs relied on this representation in estimating the length of trial and selecting a jury. In view of the trial court's broad authority to control its courtroom, it was not unreasonable for the court to decline to add these witnesses and prolong the trial when a jury had already been chosen twice based on certain representations about its length. The trial court also did not improvidently exercise its discretion in allowing only a limited number of the plaintiff's records from Ferncliff Manor to be admitted into evidence. It is clear that these records required at least some redaction, including to eliminate double hearsay and propensity evidence, because defendants refused to propose any redactions. After having been given ample opportunities to do so, the trial court was justified in adopting plaintiff's proposed redactions instead." That concludes this October 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE.